Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, January 31st, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups. Please note that all expressions of opinion on the call today are those of the experts. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. And we're very pleased today to have two speakers, one of whom is going to act as our moderator and who will introduce the other speaker and lead the discussion. Our moderator today is the Honorable Tammy D. McCutcheon. She's the former administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the U.S. Department of Labor, and she's currently a shareholder at the Littler Mendelson Law Firm. And perhaps most importantly for my purposes anyhow, she's chairman of the Labor and Employment Law Practice Group Executive Committee of the Federalist Society. As I say, she's going to moderate and lead the discussion. So with that, Tammy McCutcheon, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. I appreciate it.
I am very excited today to have with us on our phone call Lawrence DiNardo, who represented U.S. Steel very ably in the recent Supreme Court decision that came out on Monday, Sandifer versus U.S. Steel. Larry is the Labor and Employment Practice Group leader at Jones Day, a member of the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers. He received both his undergraduate degree and his law degree from Notre Dame, where he has also served as a visiting professor of law. Larry's trial and appellate experience is very extensive. He's tried more than 35 cases to jury verdict and handled an equal number of cases for federal and state appellate courts, including, as I said, representing U.S. Steel in the Sandifer case, where he garnered an amazing 9-0 win for U.S. Steel, except, of course, for Justice Sotomayor, who disagreed only with footnote 7, which I'm sure we'll get around to talking about today. Larry, can you start us off by reviewing the background of the case? I'm sure our audience wouldn't also mind hearing about the collective bargaining history of the donning and doffing time at U.S. Steel.
Sure. I'll try to do this relatively quickly. So we had a group of production and maintenance employees from the Geary Works, a large steel mill along Lake Michigan, that brought this case in the Northern District of Indiana. And they claimed that they were required to be paid for time spent changing into and out of their protective work clothing each shift, and traveling to and from their locker rooms and the bathhouses that exist there at the facility to the actual work sites where they performed their productive work. Just a note about this Geary Works. So this facility extends over about 15 to 20 miles across the lakefront, actually two exits on the Indiana Toll Road. There are about 40 locker rooms or bathhouses. There's a variety of circumstances required for the employees to get to where they actually work. So some employees are able to walk just a few minutes. Others, it's quite a long walk. Yet others take shuttle buses. Some can park relatively close to the actual hundreds of buildings on this campus, if you will. Others can park close. Others cannot park very close. So a lot of differences. For about 60 years, the steel workers, the United Steelworkers of America, and U.S. Steel, as part of a national agreement that actually covers five or six other facilities, have had what they have referred to as a portal-to-portal activities provision in this agreement. So about 60 years, and under that provision, the time I just described, the changing into your protective work clothing, changing out of it at the end of the shift, traveling to and from where you work. And in the case of some employees who are by law required to shower before they can leave the facility, the showering time is all excluded from compensable time. So the district court determined that the clothes changing and washing fell within the scope of 2030 and that the appropriate collective bargaining provision existed. And so therefore, none of this time was time for which the employees were employed. The agreement was lawful, and no compensation was required. The court also held, though, the district court, that notwithstanding that it could rule as a matter of law that the clothes changing and washing was 2030 activity, the court said it could not rule as a matter of law that the travel time might nonetheless be compensable. In other words, that even though 2030 took clothes changing out of the arena of compensability, it still could be a principal activity. Continuous workday rule would therefore mean that, even though that time did not require compensation, it still started the workday. The consequence of that would be the employer would lose the shield, if you will, or the non-liability that exists under the Portal of Portal Act for getting yourself to the place where you perform the first principal activity for which you've been employed. And as I said, in some cases, this is a 20-minute shuttle ride each way. So district court said, we can't decide that on summary judgment. We took a 1292B or interlocutory appeal to Seventh Circuit on that question. Of course, to answer that question, you had to answer the close changing question first anyway. Seventh Circuit adopted a you-know-it-when-you-see-it definition of close. Or it's an interesting opinion. It's worth reading, Judge Posner's opinion. The other way to characterize what the Seventh Circuit did on the close question was to say a picture is worth a thousand words, and that's the standard. And, of course, a law clerk of Judge Posner is photographed and included in the opinion. That law clerk is actually now a U.S. Supreme Court law clerk, so he's had quite a bit of publicity. The court went on, though, to say that the clothes changing, being non-compensable, being not part of the workday, the travel time is also excluded under the Portal to Portal Act, that the Sixth Circuit is incorrect. There's a Sixth Circuit decision that predated our decision. Sixth Circuit is incorrect when it said that 2030 activities can start the workday, recognizing a split was created. So then, of course, the petition for cert was granted only as to the question of what's clothes changing, not the question of whether excluded 2030 activity can nonetheless start the workday. A word about the Department of Labor's position, so just so this is clear. In the Seventh Circuit, the Department of Labor only joined the debate as to what is clothes changing, not as to whether excluded clothes changing can start the workday. And so what the Department of Labor said in the Seventh Circuit was, if the items have protective aspects, which these items do, then they cannot be considered clothes within the meaning of 2030. And so therefore, not clothes, not 2030 activity, the employer owes compensation. No comment, though, on what that means to the Portal to Portal Act. And I point that out because in the Supreme Court, where the Department of Labor took our side, joined as friend of the court on behalf of the respondent, it was weighing in on the clothes changing question. And yes, it reversed the positions it had taken in bulletins, but not in this case as such. There's the guidances from 2010, I think, where the Department of Labor said, if the items have protective aspects, they can't be clothes. So, yes, that position was abandoned by the Department of Labor through the Solicitor General's office, obviously. Nothing was said about the travel time issue by the DOL. So that brings us, I think, Tammy, to the Supreme Court.
It does indeed. Do you want to talk about the decision, 9-0?
Yes. Now, you know, there's been a lot said about this 9-0 business, but in candor here, I think we don't know what the statistics will be this year, but if I'm remembering correctly, it's not unusual in a term of the court for most of the cases to be decided 9-0. We're all used to, I guess, the media noise about all of these closely divided decisions that come out in June, et cetera, giving the general impression that we have a very narrowly divided court. But I think in a majority of the cases, they're all 9-0. So, yes, it's been great publicity for my law firm and for me, but I think it's not all that unusual at the end of the day. So what did the Supreme Court do? Well, Justice Scalia and the court decided that the word close in 2030 denotes items that are both designed and used to cover the body and are commonly regarded as articles of dress. That clothes includes protective gear designed to protect against workplace hazards. So that's a good thing. That's a very good thing. I think it's the absolute right answer. It puts to rest this notion of the Department of Labor, as I said, in some of its guidances and some of the decisions out of the Ninth Circuit, for example, and the plaintiff's bar's position that if it's protective, it can't be clothing. So I think we're done with that debate. The court also said that, quote, changing, the word changing in 2030, means more than substituting one item for another, more than exchanging. It includes adding coverings to what employees might already be wearing. Again, I think a well-reasoned conclusion. It puts to rest that whole debate. You have to take off your blue jeans before you put on your flame-resistant pants at a steel mill in order to be covered by 2030, or can you simply put those pants on over your blue jeans, which is kind of a common thing. So fairly arcane stuff, but those two conclusions are stated without reservation. In terms of putting on or taking off some items that are not clothes, within the court's definition of clothes, we know now that that sort of non-clothes activity will not disqualify the block of changing time from protection under 2030. So 2030, in the words of the court, can apply to the entire period of time spent in changing clothes or washing if, this is the quote, on the whole, the period at issue can be fairly characterized as time spent changing clothes or washing. So it certainly takes care of the time spent retrieving clothes in the locker room, getting a towel for washing, turning a shower on, and those non-clothes items, in our case, for example, the earplugs, the respirator, the safety glasses. Yeah, and certainly suggests that if a whistle which we wouldn't call clothing, or some sort of measuring gauge or a tool of some kind, et cetera, is part of this process, it doesn't take us out of 2030. So those are good things. So I think that's where the Supreme Court puts us.
So, Larry, do you think this ends future litigation, or are there still issues for plaintiffs to try to litigate?
All right. So, what issues are left open? I think there are actually several. And just to kind of put this in context for a few minutes, we had urged two positions that would have provided more clarity or more certainty than we have. So there are uncertainties left. But let me just mention those two, and we can consider how they fit together, because I think that will tell us much about what's going to happen in the future in terms of litigation. So in terms of clothes, we urged that the entire work outfit put on to be ready to work without regard to the nature of an individual item was what the word clothes meant. In 2030. So the referee's whistle, the scuba tank for a diver working on an offshore oil rig, for example. And we urged that, yes, the word clothes maybe is not readily, you wouldn't readily conclude from that word that it really means the entire outfit. But in the context of the debate, in the legislative history of the debate, in the context of the 1947 Portal to Portal Act amendment, use of the term preliminary or post-preliminary, and then the immediate guidance by Department of Labor saying, oh, so some clothes changing might not be preliminary or post-preliminary under the Portal to Portal Act. And then the swift reaction to Congress in 1949, they just grabbed the word clothes. So that was the import of the argument. Well, the court was not going to accept that. We thought we had a chance on that point, that contextually and textually together, clothes really meant the entire outfit. So, and particularly given who wrote the opinion, that was not going to work, and it didn't. So there are going to be arguments in the future, I think, about some items, just as there have been in the past. And while those items might be coverings, they're going to fail the second part of the court's announced definition, commonly regarded as dress. So that is left. Now, if I can
so
just
for the so before yeah. you move on, so because yeah. they adopted like this basically a dictionary definition that they're designed and used to cover the body. We're still in the item-by-item evaluation, like the court did here. They looked at 12 items, and they said these 9 are clothing and these 3 are not.
So the clearly, at that point in the opinion, we're left with, distressingly as far as I'm concerned, this item-by-item focus, and you wind up on that focus, with that focus, because in my judgment, an overly, an excessive obsession, if you will, with that one word clothes in the statute. But yes, the item
well,
by item.
I remember in oral arguments, Scalia, when you were talking, raising up his wristwatch and saying, that's not clothes.
Right.
So
well,
at that point, you had an idea, huh?
No, I had an idea. Well, we anticipated this. You know, there's a certain amount of irony here. We were talking largely about allow the freedom of collective bargaining and the parties that are best suited to settle these issues, allow that to have, to take the fore and not have judges deciding, can I find a definition somewhere that makes the thing a piece of clothing so I can rule in a particular way? But I knew I was in trouble when he said, there was another comment by Judge Justice Scalia when he said, you are trying to make liars out of us. This is when I knew I was really in trouble on this point. But in any event, so when you get to that point in the opinion, clothes, and it's not just the covering for the body part, Tammy, I think that causes this problem. It's the second part, commonly referred to as clothing. So it's that part of his test that is probably more problematic. But here, now the second point that we urged to the court was that 2030 is about a transaction. Maybe that wasn't the best term, but when I tell you we wrestled and we had a lot of help in the moots on this one, we're trying to figure out a way to make this point. It's about a transaction, the transaction of changing clothes or a block of time. It's the activity, not the items. And we worked into the briefing and the arguments. Incidental steps don't matter. So opening the locker doesn't matter. Going to the window to get the clothes or going to the window to get the towel, that's not washing or changing. But clearly, those are incidental steps associated with all of this. And if that's right, then the incidental, the referee putting the whistle around his or her neck or the worker grabbing a tool that fits into a belt, that don't decide whether that's clothes or not. This, of course, fit in with this transactional notion, fit in with our other point, our first point, that we're talking about the work outfit. What do you need to put on to be ready to work? So in good measure, I think the court really adopted this transactional approach. So you'll see towards the end of the opinion, and I think maybe one of the most important lines in the opinion, I hope, the court writes, quote, the question for courts is whether the period at issue can, on the whole, and on the whole is emphasized in the court's opinion, on the whole be fairly characterized as, and then the court quotes 2030, as time spent in changing clothes or washing. That's a transactional approach.
And that was great. But the next two sentences.
No, I'll get to that in a minute. But let me make one point before those next two sentences. I don't know exactly where they came from, but I think as I was facing the bench, they came from my far left, those next two sentences. But let's hold that for a moment.
Right.
So that transactional approach, I hope and I believe, diminishes a bit, at least, the potential confusion remaining from the court's use of the phrase in the definition part of the opinion, the use of the phrase, quote, commonly regarded as articles of dress. Now we get to the next two sentences, and I think you're right on here, Tammy. Right after this adoption of a transactional approach, the court then comments on two extremes. You know, Wyatt, this was, I suppose, maybe the price of a 9-0 opinion, who knows. But the court then comments on two extremes and says, if the vast majority of time is on non-close items, then the entire period would not qualify, if the vast majority. So pregnant in that comment is, what about if just a majority is on non-close items? Not a vast majority, just a majority.
And what is a vast majority?
Right. But let's suppose it's 52% non-close. All the court did in giving us a couple of parameters after adopting the transactional approach, right? The very useful, on the whole, fairly characterized language, which is a pretty darn good guide to us, which right after giving us that pretty good guide, it then says if the vast majority is on a non-close item, then the entire period would not qualify under 2030. And then, of course, we have the other extreme in the next sentence. If the vast majority on what we have defined as close, then the time on the non-close doesn't matter. In effect, that's what the court said. Well, what if a bare majority is close? So we have this, if I might, no man's land. And I would suggest that as we will inevitably have to litigate some of these things going forward, that if you're in that no man's land, where do you go? I think you revert back to the court's general statement just before these extremes are included. The question for the court is, can the activity be fairly characterized as time spent in changing clothes? At least.
Yeah, and I think that's so important, Larry, that as management side employers representing, you know, lawyers representing employers, if we get one of these cases, we really need to focus the whatever court we're in's attention on the activity changing as a whole, because and say that's the real ruling, and this vast majority standard is just meant to what, to reiterate that meaning.
Well, I think it's who knows, because none of us were in the conference, right? But
right.
I think it's in the decision because the court is, in fact, concerned about not having limits. You know, what if an employer decides we're going to turn our employees into beasts of burden, if you will, to carry all kinds of materials that are going to be needed when they get to their machine, or all kinds of equipment, et cetera, as part of the locker room activities. We don't want that result. And I think this is maybe a way of preventing that result. We also don't want to, we don't want the result where one item of clothing, of what can fairly be called clothing, everyone would call it clothing, is involved in the process. But otherwise, you know, you're operating a piece of equipment or machinery before you get to where you're actually going to use that piece of equipment. So I think it's they're staking out that there needs to be some moderation here. It wasn't done as artfully as possible, perhaps, but I think that's what that's all about.
I think my fear is that some court will adopt the vast majority as like the standard and forget about that prior sentence, that you look at the activity as a whole.
But that's clearly a misreading, because the court said, if the vast majority is not is non-close, then you can't use 2030. It could have said, if a vast majority was required for 2030, it could have said, if a majority is non-close, then it's not 2030. But it said vast. So it set a high standard, if you will, for disqualification, for the non-ability of the union and the employer to use 2030. So I suspect there was some back and forth on that sentence, and it may have started, if the majority is non-close, then 2030 doesn't work, and that wasn't acceptable. So it wound up with, if the vast majority is non-close. So we have to see, and if you remember, the very end of oral argument is perhaps an indicator of how reluctant the court is going to be to have to delve into this again for a long, long time. If you remember when Justice Kagan said, why doesn't the Department of Labor adopt a rule, a regulation, clarify this? And Justice Scalia said, well, I can answer that. It's too complicated.
But I will tell you, when we were writing the 2002 opinion letter, I argued for taking a position that even the definition of close should be left up to the bargaining process. But I was overruled.
Yes, and I think you're correct. I think your position there was absolutely correct. But I did my best here. So
and if you research who was Solicitor of Labor in 2002, you'll know who overruled me.
Right. I think I know. So let me talk about another big question that I think is there, and that I think we'll see a good bit of litigation over. And that's the question that wasn't taken. Can 2030 activity start the workday? Is the protection of the Portal Act, where an employer doesn't have to pay for that travel time, is that not available, even where 2030 is available? Now, it makes no sense to me, because 2030 was a patch that was put on the lack of definition in the Portal Act that talked about not just travel time being non-compensable, but the general term preliminary or post-preliminary activities. And the 1949 2030 definition was to add a patch to the language preliminary, post-preliminary. So wouldn't it be ironic if something meant to clarify that that travel time and preliminary and post-preliminary activities would not be compensable? That is the definition in 2030 that came in 1949. Wouldn't it be ironic if this crazy construction of 2030 that the Sixth Circuit has adopted prevails, and an employer winds up nonetheless losing the shield of the Portal Act? So we have, as I said, three circuits now have ruled on that question. The Sixth, before the Seventh Circuit case, said, yes, 2030 activity can start the workday. Then, of course, we had the Seventh that created the 1-1 split. And then while this case was pending in the Supreme Court, the Eighth Circuit said, the Seventh Circuit has it right. So I think there's going to be a good bit of litigation over that.
So why didn't the Supreme Court take it up, since there was a circuit split at the time that the petition?
Hard to know. It was clearly I shouldn't say clearly, but it was the more interesting and subtle issue, I believe. The split on the question of close, if it has protective aspects, can it be closed, was about five or six circuits to one. It was just the Ninth Circuit's decision in Alvarez that said if there's protective aspects, it can't be clothing. So if these jackets are treated, these pants are treated, or the boots have a metatarsal plate, that's not closed because they protect. That decision stood alone. Every other court said, no, the fact that the items have protective aspects doesn't take it out of the definition of close. So we, in fact, argue that the Supreme Court should not take the question, the one that they took, because the Ninth Circuit case stood there alone, and if given an opportunity to follow the other later and better reasoned cases, it would do it, et cetera. The court took the case anyway. But it didn't take the travel time case, And it's there, and you know, I think there'll be a good bit of litigation over that.
Two other things about the opinion that I'd like you to comment on. I've had both colleagues and clients ask me whether de minimis is dead since the Supreme Court adopted this vast majority standard instead of the de minimis standard or the ancillary activity standard that DOL had suggested during oral arguments. So what do you think? Is the concept of de minimis still alive?
So I think the rejection of the de minimis standard in the context of determining the scope of 2030 is actually the right conclusion. In other words, you don't ask, was the amount of time spent putting the earplugs in or putting the respirator hook on your hard hat or putting the protective eyewear on your hard hat. You don't ask, was that de minimis, that little bit of time? What you ask is, was this essentially, can it fairly be said that this activity was changing clothes? So I do actually believe that that is the sounder theoretical basis, doctrinal basis for the right conclusion. I don't think it impacts at all the use of the de minimis rule in the context of a little bit of time spent perhaps pushing the button on you're in a call center and you have to start your computer. So you push the button and start the computer before your paid time. Some people do it when they get in the building, 25 minutes before they actually start work, when they go to the coffee shop in between. Other people might do it 1 minute before they're required to be online. So I think those kinds of applications of de minimis are not impacted by what the court did here. I think it simply rejected the de minimis notion in the context of considering the nature of the overall activity, as the court said, quote, as a whole, close quote.
Right, under 3.0. So it's still alive and kicking, for example, for donning and doffing issues in the non-union context.
Good point. Certainly. In the donning and it's only in determining whether 2030 works in a particular place. And, of course, in a non-union context, 2030 has no application. So if someone has to walk into a retail store, take their jacket off in the back, and put on their Walgreens smock to go eat, right, I think de minimis clearly is something that applies there. Or, as I said, starting up the computer or grabbing something you need, grabbing your badge or whatever it is, I think absolutely.
And the interesting thing about that is that this, you know, Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit, he just said, well, you know, whether or not a hat is closed, I don't know, but it only takes a few seconds to put on, so it's de minimis, and he shoved out those issues aside.
Right.
But I think there's still an issue about de minimis to be litigated because the DOL has long taken the position that to be de minimis, the activity has to be only a few seconds or a few minutes, but also can't occur regularly.
Right. Not subject to measurement and not occur regularly, right?
Right.
Right.
And there are plenty of courts that haven't looked at the regularity part of it. They've only looked at the time it takes. So
yes.
I think there's...
I wouldn't be too hard with Judge Posner on this issue because, we, of course, frankly never occurred to us until I read Justice Scalia's opinion, that the whole notion of de minimis in the context of my argument about is the transaction changing clothes really
right.
doesn't have any place. So we didn't help the Seventh Circuit or the district court on the issue. But I think I think you're right. I believe de minimis outside this context continues to live on. It's a valid concept, and there'll be a lot of litigation around the edges. You know, what exactly does that mean?
Can we turn to footnote 7, with which Justice Sotomayor disagreed?
Right.
And, of course, for our listeners, in In footnote 7, Justice Scalia cited his own opinion in the Christopher versus Smith-Klein-Beacham case to decline to interpret Section 3.0 narrowly because it's in the definition section, just like the word sales is, rather than in Section 2.13, which houses most of the exemptions from overtime and minimum wage. Larry, do you think this is a chink in the armor of the whole, canon of construction for FLSA that we've been dealing with for years, that everything is construed narrowly against the employer?
Well, I think it's a rear guard action by those who are trying to hold on to the notion that certain sections of a statute should be narrowly construed, in particular the Fair Labor Standards Act. So we have this fairly well-entrenched theory that if it's an exemption, so if the employer's not going to have to pay for something that it would otherwise have to pay for, the words, so in Section 213, the exemption section, those words should be narrowly construed. Then you have another school of thought that says, well, why would words in one section be given a narrow meaning and words in other sections be given their fair or contemporaneous meaning? Well, where does that come from? So I think we have one group that wants to get to the point where all words are construed the same way, and then we have those who are resisting that sort of possible change. And I think if you read footnote 7, this is an attempt by those who want words read the same to make that point again here, and Justice Sotomayor doesn't want to go along with that. So she's saying, you haven't convinced me that this narrow construction, because you'll remember, isn't it Justice Scalito, Alito that comments in Smith-Klein, I thought, where this whole question of why do we construe words in one section differently than words in another section. Yeah. So I think she's trying to say, hey, I haven't given up on that argument.
I guess the more interesting fact is that, eight justices apparently agreed with the statement, whereas in GlaxoSmithKline, the majority had only five.
Right. So I think that might be what's going on here. And then, again, there's another possibility here. We have these cases that say something doesn't have to be in the exemption section in 213 to be an exemption. Congress could have made a mistake and put it in the definitions section. You should look at the nature of the provision, not where it's located in the codified statute. So it's possible that she wanted to preserve that position as well, that exemptions may exist outside of 213, and I'm not going to adopt any suggestion that there's some sort of mechanical way to determine where the exemptions are.
Well, and that's exactly, exactly right. And the biggest one that I can think of is the exemption for commissioned employees, which is in 207I, which is the section, of course, that sets the minimum wage, right? And it's an exemption from overtime pay. I'm sorry, 207 is overtime pay. So
that's exactly right. So I think it could be both of these things going on. Pretty subtle. She was very interested in the case, though. So, I think it's a fair point.
I guess I also think that, if you're litigating on behalf of an employer and you get a brief that automatically, quotes narrow construction, you got a basis to challenge that now.
Yeah, a little bit of help, right.
Yep.
Right, an 8-1 decision, I suppose.
That's right, on that issue.
On that issue.
I think that's sort of all the questions I had. I wanted to open it up for questions from our participants, our listeners. So if you have, Dean, can you tell us how our listeners can ask questions?
Sure thing. In a moment, everyone will hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, really, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our phones are wide open, and while we wait to see who might ring in, I'll make a programming announcement. Next week so far, we have two calls scheduled, one for Tuesday, one for Thursday. On Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the recent federal pronouncements on school discipline and disparate impact. That's Tuesday at 2 p.m. Then on Thursday, we'll be talking about the new book by Tim Sandifer, The Conscience of the Constitution. But as I say, that's just our schedule at the moment. It's quite likely we'll add some calls, so I'd urge folks to check in on the Federal Society's website on the Teleform page for additions or even changes to that schedule. Today, of course, we're talking about the Donning and Doffing case, and we're taking questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Tammy, Larry, I don't know if you've satisfied every question the audience might have had in your discussions, but right now we don't have any questions. I don't know, Tammy, if you have anything to follow up on.
While we're waiting for questions, I do encourage people to sign in and talk with us. I don't think we can end our conversation today without talking about the Department of Labor's opinions on this issue and their role in the case. And just to give a brief history of that for our listeners, DOL has issued, I think, a total of 5 opinion letters on whether the meaning of the term close, which of course allows donning and doffing time to be excluded in the union context under Section 3O. There was 2 opinion letters during the Clinton administration taking a narrow view of what clothing mean. We reversed that in the Bush administration with 2 opinions, adopting a broader interpretation and saying that protective gear is includable, is clothing. Those were in 2002 and 2007. And then in 2010, the DOL issued an administrator's interpretation, revoking the 2002 and 2007 letters and taking the position that protective clothing is not covered. And I will note that 2010 administration interpretation is, I think, one of 3 opinion letters that have been issued in the Obama administration. Larry, I'm sure I was not the only person who was surprised when DOL filed an amicus brief, in this case, flip-flopping yet again in support of U.S. Steel. And their amicus, of course, in a footnote, told the Supreme Court, ignore our 2010 opinion letter. All right. Come on. Tell us, Larry. Did you know they were going to file for your client?
So,
Come on.
It was an interesting sort of series of events, and I think it worked out fine. But the timing of all of this, we of course, were invited to make a presentation to the solicitor's office after cert was granted. Petitioners presented first. We were not present for that, of course. And there's Department of Labor folks there as well as SG's office people there. After Eric Schnapper finished, then we were invited in. They gave us a nice audience. We made a presentation, and this is a good example of why our children ask for more than they really want. So we presented and urged the government to stay out of the case. So we said, this is not a case you should get involved in. You're going to have to deal with all of this flip-flopping that follows the outcomes of presidential elections. It's going to be a giant distraction. Stay out of the case. It never occurred to us that we could ask them to join with us. It was just beyond the pale. So we urged and urged and urged to stay out. Then fast forward, the petitioner's merits brief, is filed.
And they don't file. The deadline passed.
7 days go by, and there's no filing from the SG's office. And we say, great, we succeeded in convincing the government to stay out. We succeeded in our goal. And then, of course, a few days before our brief is due, we got a call from the SG's office, and they said, can you call us back? And I said, we're not going to waive the time for them to have filed on behalf of petitioners. And we called them back, and they say, we want to join in support of your position. And I have to tell you, it was just a very, very interesting thing. And you know, it was just out of the blue as far as we were concerned. And they did, you know, I think obviously a great job. And we were pretty much glad to have them, although it made me a little nervous, given if you follow these FLSA cases over the last several years, the sides or the positions that the SG's office and DOL have taken, you know, have had a rough go of it. So I thought, oh, no.
You're like, oh, no, it's going to be
oh,
like
no, I really don't want your help. But they were great. They were great, and Tony Yang was absolutely fabulous in argument and in the briefing. Before him, he wasn't so much involved in the briefing. I'm trying to remember the fellow's name. He's left now. But Tony did a great job, and the SG's office did a great job in the briefing. So, you know,
Wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on the wall with the conversation between the SG's office and the Solicitor of Labor's office? I mean, because it's sort of embarrassing that they flip-flopped on their own position.
Right. On can protective items be clothing? So here's what we were so concerned about. What do you do when one of the justices say, so you have this footnote in your brief, so this is in the SG's office brief, you have this footnote in the brief that says, we do not ask for deference in this case. Well, what do the justices say? So deference is some sort of selective matter, is that it? It's the law in some cases and not the law in other cases? What do you mean in this case? So that was a tough question that wasn't asked.
Well, and that was, I was going to say that, you know, although one of the flip-flops had my name on it,
yes.
I just loved reading Judge Posner's decision in the Seventh Circuit about the whole deference issue. And, you know, God forbid we actually imply that this was politically motivated. It was
You just didn't want to be the Assistant Solicitor of Labor that argued in the Seventh Circuit because she was given, well, I can't remember if you attended that, but it was pretty brutal. It was quite difficult.
Well, and I was looking forward to that when attending oral arguments at the Supreme Court, and there was not one question. Why don't you think that the Supreme Court, you know, totally passed on commenting on this flip-flop when they've been doing it in other cases?
Right. And Justice Roberts, in some sort of concurrence a year or so ago, made some comment about this, that, you know, we invite the bar to address these deference issues in, you know, in perhaps a more rigorous way. I remember reading this, and I can't remember the case. It was a year or so ago.
Do you have any speculation why they didn't,
why the Supreme Court passed it? I'm not sure. I don't know. You know, it's always difficult to tell.
Well, maybe it's sort of the function of it was just so obvious, right?
Right, that, right. White
that
beat
they
a
weren't
dead
going
horse.
To,
right.
Exactly. You know, it's the lawyer in the oral argument who obviously just doesn't have the skill. So you let them go on and on and talk, and you don't ask them very many questions.
Right.
But it was there were many in the audience at the oral arguments who were disappointed in not having the discussion.
Right. No, I'm sure. We spent a lot of time preparing.
Tammy, it's Dean. I wanted to let you know we have a question pending.
Great.
If you want to turn.
Absolutely. Let's go to it.
And to the rest of the audience, if you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button. But let's go to that first caller.
Hi. Hi, Tammy and Larry. My question is, can you just confirm that if the CBA is silent on changing in and out of PPEs, we can still rely on a custom or practice?
Tammy, do you want me to start?
No, go ahead. You can take it.
Okay, so the statute specifically references custom or practice. So the exclusion of the time from hours for which an employee is employed can be pursuant to an express provision or custom or practice. So there's no doubt that in this context, custom or practice has the same force and effect as an express provision. You do point out, though, an area where there will be continued litigation, and that is what does it take to establish the existence of a customer practice.
Do you think courts will look to traditional labor law for a definition of that concept?
I think absolutely. I think that's where that concept has to be defined. And, you know, this notion of the federal courts giving effect to these traditional labor principles applies here, I think.
Right. So if you're advising an employer, if you are an employer, I think what I would say is look to the definition under the NLRB and determine whether you're going to pay or not pay for this time based on whether you meet the NLRB standards. I think that's a pretty safe thing to do as an employer, or whether you're advising an employer. But I agree with you, Larry. That issue really hasn't been litigated yet.
Yeah, in this particular case, there was a little attempt by the petitioner, a small attempt by petitioner, to suggest that you have to be a little narrow in what you do here, court, in terms of 2030, because a custom or practice can be unilateral action by an employer. And I was called on an oral argument. It didn't find.
Yeah, was that Justice Ginsburg who?
It may have been, now that I'm just not recalling, but I made the point that custom or practice is not a unilateral thing. It's something that arises at the very least through long-term acquiescence, such that we can conclude that agreement has been reached. So no harm done in that area, but I think we'll see more litigation over the question.
Yeah, I remember sitting at oral argument when you got that question, when it was explained by the petitioners that about the unilateral practice and making that point. And I can't remember whether it was Justice Ginsburg Sotomayor or one of the other.
I think it was actually Justice Breyer.
Have been Justice Breyer.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
And because the look on his face, I thought you had lost him. Because he's like, well, that's not fair.
Right.
And
yeah.
I really,
we were able to make the point that customer practice is very much akin to an agreement. It's just not an express agreement.
Right, and of course, the facts in this case, U.S. Steel, where you have a 65-year-old express provision in the CBA is the absolute best facts that any management side attorney was glad was going up. So we haven't had the tough case when the established practice is like 5 years or 4 years or 3 years. So, but I one of the things that I've been thinking about is, if your clients are having a collective bargaining agreement negotiation the next time, even though it allows a practice in under Section 3.0, it still is a good idea if you if the union is asking for some sort of concession to have the 3.0 language ready to go to insert in your collective bargaining agreement to make it explicit.
Yeah, I leave this to the traditional labor law experts, and I don't count myself among those to deal with it. But it's an important issue. Some of my colleagues have said, if you make a proposal and then it's rejected, there's danger that what you've done is made a record that there's no customer practice. So again, you need an expert on the establishment of a customer practice if you're not going to have an express provision to deal with it. But it's an important, very important point.
Dean, do we have any further questions?
We don't, but let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I don't see any additional questions at this point, Tammy.
Well, I think it's perfectly fine to end a little 5 minutes early and give back some time. Thank you very much, listeners, for joining us today, and Larry for coming and giving all of us your insights about the case. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we end?
Nothing. Thanks so much for inviting me. Frankly, this was fun. This was it was a good day.
Absolutely. I think actually one last question for you before you leave. What was the better day, finding out the DOL was going to come on your side or getting the decision?
No, I think getting the decision.
Getting the decision
was a good day, and I don't want to minimize the 9-0 was that was a great moment as well.
Right. Oh, another thing I wanted to mention before you go that you'll find interesting. If you go on DOL's website, which contains their opinion letters, the 2010 opinion letter is still showing on there as good law, and the 2002 opinion letter is showing as revoked. So we'll see how long it takes DOL to update their opinion letter page.
They may want to get a hold of their IT department.
I think they ought to. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.